one into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
Swung on,
did it,
crushed, and the Phillies are going to lead it.
Harper, the swing of his life.
The 0-2 pitch, swing and a miss, struck him out.
From WHYY, it is hitting season. Hey there, podcast pals. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on X and Blue Sky at John Stolness. Coming up, we are now, as we look ahead to what we hope will be a fruitful homestand for the Philadelphia Phillies, and coming off what, by the record, was a fruitful road trip out west, a litmus test road trip for the Phillies, 4-2 through San Diego and Los Angeles, but for no one in the fan base, or for actually, I will say, very few in the fan base, did it feel like a successful week, even though it was. So we'll talk about the road trip, we'll talk about the Phillies' flailing offense, and the numbers, folks, they will frighten you. But we'll get into all that here on this edition of Hittin' Season. Joining me here on the roundtable, Elizabeth Rocher and Justin LQ. Made up his middle initial, I have no idea what his middle name
is. And his last name. I think you might have said cube.
Did I say Q?
I think you might have said Q or cube.
I like it better. Yeah. Anyway, we're going to go with that.
Folks,
we're gonna
it's 7:30 in the morning.
I don't make mistakes
all
at 7:30 in the morning.
All cylinders.
That's right. Joining me to talk about it is Liz Rocher and Justin Clue. Justin is from Baseball Prospectus. He's also author of the book Summer of the Cheap Wieners, in which he takes a deep dive into the 1941 Phillies, which they will be mentioned again on this podcast coming up in just a few minutes. Follow him on Blue Sky at Justin Clue. Justin, how you feeling, buddy?
My natural trend finding and projecting has paid off once again, as I knew this would be the summer of the 1941 Phillies. It's all anyone's talking about across town, from a Blue Sky post from several weeks ago to a Blue Sky post from a day ago. There's just nonstop chatter out there comparing this team to the 111 loss 1941 Phillies, and I gotta tell you, it is great news for everybody.
Yes, this is what we wanted at the start of the season, was for this 2026 Phillies team to mirror one of the all-time worst teams in baseball history, and yet that is what we are seeing.
Wouldn't it be great if we said that we could just replicate the darkest chapter in Phillies history, or at least one of? Yeah,
that would have. We're doing it, guys.
Yeah,
we're making it happen.
It's
Liz Rocher is
clearly
the editor of Sabres Baseball Research Journal. Follow her on X and Blue Sky at Liz Rocher. Liz, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks. It's a sunny day. It's early in the morning. The Phillies are on today. I'm bracing myself, obviously.
Yes, we are all bracing ourselves to watch this team come back home to take on these very same Padres that they just swept a week ago this time, or started the sweep a week ago this time at Citizens Bank Park now, as the Phillies will get them at home. And, you know, it was a weird week to be a Phillies fan. They went 4-2, like I mentioned, on this West Coast road trip against two teams in the National League West with very good records. The Phillies also went 18-10 in the month of May. That was the second best record of any team in the National League. But does it feel like it? It doesn't to most of us. It doesn't feel like this baseball team had a successful May and had a successful West Coast road trip, because while the starting pitching has been otherworldly, the offense has been a real problem for this team. And we know that it's come and gone over the years. It's been dead, and then it wakes up, and then it goes back to sleep at the wrong times. But so far here, through the first 2 months of the 2026 season, the offense has been brutal. I've got some numbers to share in just a second, but Liz, I wanted to throw this your way first. Like, how do you feel about the week that was? Going 4-2 on the West Coast road trip, it's what we said we wanted. Do you feel satisfied? Are you pleased with how last week went?
If you're just looking at the games they won, sure. I mean, I felt really good after that Padres sweep. I felt like, all right, they're really doing it. And then they get blanked by the Dodgers the next night, win, you know, by the skin of their teeth another, and get completely embarrassed on Sunday. That was a difficult one that I'm going to admit I turned off pretty early. I had to preserve my sanity. So I'm glad they did what they did on the West Coast, though the way they did it isn't really pleasing me nor anyone else.
This was very close to a full three-game embarrassment in Los Angeles. That one win in the middle is doing a lot of heavy lifting, which means one Edmundo Sosa home run is doing a lot of heavy lifting. I think if you wanted to stay positive, you could make the argument that maybe the difference between this Phillies team and a more lousy or middling Phillies team is that they lose all three of those games, and that this team actually did find a way to win one of those middle games and turn it into a winning road trip so that we could point to that and say, all right, well, how bad could things be if they are still winning games? And like you said, John, that 18-10 record was among the best in baseball. And like, does it even matter how it feels right now? A time of year when winning is winning and you got to just rack up as many wins as you can. And if you're winning more than you're losing, then you're doing your job. But I think at this point, the reality in the National League is that there's playing everybody else, and then there's playing the Dodgers. And we said even on this show that we couldn't wait to see the Phillies in this more competitive state take on better competition and play their way out of the two Ohio teams who, by the way, beat them in their series before taking on these two heavier challengers in the Padres and Dodgers. And seeing them play so well against the Padres, you think, oh, this is great. They got a better shot against the Dodgers. But I posit that the same team showed up for both series. You just saw the way the Phillies are built work against the Padres and not work most of the time against the Dodgers. So, you know, there's when you get that measuring stick as an NL contender to play the Dodgers, you want to see positive results of some kind. And the Phillies did not see a ton of positive results, even based on some stuff that was working in San Diego that didn't work in Los Angeles. So when you say, does it matter how it feels? Statistically, no, but also, you know, emotionally, yeah, it does. The Phillies want to know that they can beat the Dodgers. The Phillies want to believe that they can hang with the Dodgers, and everybody watching wants to believe that too. And in this series, they just really didn't look like they were doing that.
Well, I think the thing about this road trip, and I think this thing about the month of May, is yes, they went 18-10, but the way they went about going 18-10 is not going to be repeatable. Christopher Sanchez did not give up a run the entire month. That's probably not going to happen again. And if it does, he's going to set the all-time record for scoreless inning streak and break Oral Hershiser's record. That's a once in a every other generation type run that Christopher Sanchez is going on right now. Zach Wheeler had a tremendous month of May. Really, up until the last start, when he gave up four solo home runs in the game on Friday against the Dodgers, he had been unhittable throughout the entire month. And Jesus Luzardo had a really good month. I mean, you're just not going to get that level of production from your starting pitching to mask the offensive woes that this team continues to have. And you know, they do have a winning record right now, but how they've gotten there, if you're projecting during the course of the rest of the regular season, they can't keep playing the way they have been, even during a successful month of May, and expect it to have similar results in June, July, August, September. The Phillies have one of the worst offenses in baseball, and it's not just against left-handed pitching anymore, although that is still their big kryptonite, and I don't know how that gets solved. But overall, as a team, lefties, righties, ambidextrous pitchers, whoever, they are hitting .224 through their first 59 games. Now, I know batting average is not the end-all be-all of offensive statistics, but still, when you have the second-worst batting average in baseball, you're not a good hitting team. That .224 batting average, by the way, through 59 games, is the lowest batting average in franchise history through the team's first 59 games. I was trying to find it through the month of May. They don't let you break it down that way in Baseball Reference, so I went through their first 59 games. Their .224 average, the lowest in franchise history, beating out Justin's 1941 Phillies, who through their first 59 games had a .226 batting average. That team, as Justin mentioned a few moments ago, went 43-111. So when those are the types of folks you're dancing with, You're not a good offense. You are a struggling offense. This is, and it's even going a little bit beyond struggling offense. You are historically bad. The other teams that this 26 Phillies team is mixing with, the 1970 Phillies, who are third on this list with a .228 batting average, they went 73-88. The 1961 Phillies had a .230 batting average through their first 59 games. They went 47-107. And the 1971 Phillies also had a .230 average through their first 59 games. They went 67-95. And if you don't like batting average, you're looking at on-base percentage. The Phillies are dead last in the majors in on-base percentage at .292. And it's the fifth worst start in franchise history in terms of on-base percentage in Phillies history here. So I mean, yeah, Justin, I'm going to, as the resident expert on the 1941 Phillies, thanks to his book over my right shoulder, Summer of the Cheap Wieners, like compare these two teams. Because, I mean, yes, this is a $300 million payroll doing this right now. This is not the company you want to be keeping.
Yeah, I'd say we could start right there if you were comparing these two teams. I mean, A, the projections and predictions about the 2026 Phillies are somewhat more sizable than they were in 1941, when a city barely blinked at the Phillies stumbling out the gate. And as you can read in the book, cost them a lot of concessions. Almost all of their concession sales at one point cost their manager his eyesight. They played so poorly. The acquisition of this roster in 1941, also very different. You had guys writing in to say, hey, if you pay for my leg surgery, I'll come play for the Phillies and you won't have to pay me. Or, you know, I play on all these sandlots and I'm just going to be around. So you can either hire me now or like hire me later. You know, they had all kinds of ways, you know, all kinds of ways to just reach a hook out a second floor window and just kind of like bring a guy in if they needed it. Like, hey, you look like you're moderately athletic. Get in here. You'd accept pennies or peanuts for money, right? Meanwhile, this roster was assembled using actual money and almost more than anybody else used money to acquire their roster. So yeah, it kind of puts the teams in a little bit of a different framing, which honestly, that's the most disturbing part of this. It's not that another Phillies team in our lifetime sunk to these levels of offensive ineptitude. We all knew that would happen at some point. It's that it's happening to this team that has the aspirations it has and the, you know, pressure they'll tell you is on them after coming up short for the last 4 years as a playoff team and presuming to be a playoff team this year and putting themselves in a hole. And this is not what you wanted to see. Even if you knew this was coming, even if you could have predicted that, like, this is a team that's built on its starting pitching being a strength and its offense being enough, the offense still has to be enough in that scenario. And when you have no player on your team get more than two hits over a three-game series, your offense isn't really doing its job. Their offense really isn't being enough, which is its job on this team. So any comparison to 1941 is going to be a rough comparison, but that the comparison is happening at all is probably more disturbing in general.
And I don't think anyone of us expects this Phillies team to lose 111 games. I mean, they've already piled up enough wins to make that virtually impossible, but I think it speaks to...
I don't know. The math is there. I did some numbers and... with a couple extra games, they could really work this out.
That's true. That's true. A couple other notes here, Liz. Over their last 11 games, the Phillies have scored 26 runs and 59 hits. MLB.com's Paul Casella notes, the last time they had that few of each over an 11-game stretch was in 1968, and prior to that, it was 1908. Again, historically bad offense. During the road trip, the offense hit 169. They had a 229 on-base percentage. A 339 slugging percentage. They've scored the fourth fewest runs in Major League Baseball. And in terms of position player, Fangraphs wins above replacement, this $300 million roster has the fourth fewest wins above replacement from their position players. And I can tell you right now, that is almost all consisting in Bryce Harper, Kyle Schwarber, and Brandon Marsh. And so, yes, we know what the problem is. We've identified the problem. There's problems at every position. The Phillies do not have a high performer really at any position other than first base, DH, and left field. So is this a problem that can be fixed? I keep seeing people saying, you know, the Phillies need to get a right-handed hitter at the trade deadline. Is that going to do it? Even if you get a good one? Like, is that going to fix it?
That guy doesn't exist. We proved that in the winter.
Yeah. Where are you going to find one? Are you going to, like, I watched Lord of the Rings recently. I'm like, is there a baseball player farm underneath the ground somewhere where they're pulling guys out and, like, birthing? Like, unless it's that, there's no way that the Phillies are going to be able to find someone without parting with something they need. You know, like, the best player they have to trade, I think we've all noticed, it's Brandon Marsh. But he's now too good to trade because he's one of the only good players on the team, one of the only productive players. Getting rid of him is giving up, I would say. You get rid of Brandon Marsh, the best player on your team, who's making almost nothing, you're giving up. I don't know how they fix this. Like, it's definitely not going to be through a trade. And so that leaves them with their farm system, which, I mean, isn't much to look at.
Well, I want to talk about the farm system too, because you're right. If there are things they could do. Like, I mean, we've seen the Mike Trout conversation. Former Angels manager Joe Maddon was on Scott Lauber's podcast, where he was talking about Mike Trout. Like, he was asked, you know, having managed Mike Trout, what would it take? You know, and basically the Angels would have to go to Mike Trout and say, hey, it's time. We're rebuilding. We'd like to move you. Would you be interested in being moved? And then a conversation can be facilitated. But even then, it carries risk for the Phillies that they may not want to engage in because of how many holes there are on the roster right now. You know, you could move Bryce Harper back to right field, and you could try and trade for someone like Boston's Wilson Contreras, who's having a fantastic season. The Astros, are they going to be a point in July where maybe they say it's not our year? They move Christian Walker. But again, does just adding one of those guys fix this? And with the farm system point you bring up, Dave Dombrowski came aboard back ahead of the 2021 season. And one of the things he did in his first year was take an overall look at the organization, top to bottom. What's working, what's not. And one of the things he zeroed in on was fixing the player development part of this franchise, how they draft. It wasn't working with the way they would develop players, and no one was on the same page. And so there's been this grand effort to get the farm system to be a productive pipeline of players. Well, we're sitting here 6 years later. Yes, the Phillies graduated Andrew Painter. He's now in the big league rotation, not having much success early on. But again, it's early. Justin Crawford had some initial success early in the first month of the season. He's having a really tough time right now, but you're not going to give up on him in center field at this point. You're going to keep hitting him ninth, and you're going to keep hoping that he improves and polishes his defense, and that's fine. But the future of those guys, while you can be optimistic, is still largely unwritten. Aiden Miller, we found out this week, still has a bad back, still is not engaging in baseball activities. There is a real possibility he doesn't play at all in 2026, which essentially makes him unavailable for the start of 2027 season, even if his back does heal, which was kind of like a hinge point, like with this Alec Bohm situation. That was going to be the replacement. That doesn't look like that's going to happen at this point. And there is nothing else in the organization that you can pluck up from the minors right now and say, Adolis Garcia, we're going to DFA him because we have somebody pushing for at-bats. We have somebody pushing Trey Turner. We have somebody pushing Bryson Stott. Even if you're not going to replace those guys full-time, there's nothing there. They have a bottom 10 farm system still. And even the guys you've traded away, Starlin Cabba, Eduardo Taillade, all these guys, they're struggling as players in the upper minors. So, I mean, you just haven't produced anything. There's nothing to grab onto. And so what have we been doing these last 6 years with the farm system? There's been no improvement there. And that's as big a problem here as what the major league players are doing, because the big guys aren't producing, and there is nothing in the farm system in AAA or even AA where you could say, yes, this guy's a future all-star. He's really pushing for at-bats in the major leagues. It's just not happening right now, and that's really frustrating and damaging.
Nobody's going to be upset to see a World Series architect like Dave Dombrowski come to town, but you can look back at his hiring and kind of question, you know, if he's got this reputation as a guy who comes in and uses a fertile farm system to both supplement a major league roster, but then also make big trades and bring in huge talent and successfully win a World Series. The Phillies were missing a key component of that formula when he got here. In 2021, their farm system was ranked around 22nd to 24th in all of baseball. And today, it's ranked around like 17th to 20th in baseball. And I can tell you from experience, that doesn't mean it's on its way up. It's just kind of like bubbling around the mid-teens to mid-20s as it has been for better part of a decade. Certainly the entire time Dombrowski has been here, because... And perhaps there are examples, exceptions to this to point to, but reputationally, he's not an executive who rebuilds your farm system. He doesn't prioritize rebuilding your farm system. It certainly isn't the flagship thing that he offers as your roster building executive. He's the guy that uses it as a tool to improve the team, and that really hasn't happened, because we're not even talking about great players coming out of the farm system. It's about needing acceptable big league players so that when you say, well, we need a guy here, you can just reach for him and he's a bus ride away from Lehigh Valley. And there's not even a whole lot of that going on. So that when you have a plan like, well, let's pay another guy $10 million to play in this position and be this kind of bat, there's a you know, 50-50 shot basically that he won't, but we're willing to bet on this guy because this guy will be different from the other guys. It just makes that plan have to work. And then when it doesn't, it becomes a full-fledged disaster because the backup plan is like, Felix Reyes, I guess? So you don't even have, like, a reliable pool of, like, acceptable big league bats to come up and, like, maybe take advantage of a hot streak where one of them's, you know, it's aligning with a need at a particular position. You don't even have a whole lot of that. So you wind up in these positions very quickly where you're a $300 million team with these big holes that you really shouldn't have. I don't know. You can't put like the blame of the Phillies' cursed mystery of their farm system on Dave Dombrowski in its entirety on him, which I'm not doing. It's just, you know, he's mentioned being a full service franchise in the past, and it just the Phillies just aren't there in this regard. And you can really see the impact of that at the major league level.
Yeah, Liz, I mean, I know you mentioned, and they have used the farm system to get some good big league talent. And like Justin said, that is Dave Dombrowski's specialty. I mean, the farm system did get them Joan Duran, and that's mm-hmm. a big deal. That's you know, a major get. And they've used the farm system to get, you know, lesser players over previous trade deadlines and whatnot. But really, what they wanted this farm system to do and what they're hoping that Andrew Painter and Justin Crawford do is provide that, you know, provide some value with young players to supplement an aging roster. But I guess you lay it at the feet of these players like Trey Turner, who's, you know, a $300 million player, at these established veterans like Bryson Stott, who, hey, had a great six-game streak, okay? The other 50 games, 53 games, you know, we're still struggling to get the batting average over .220. You know, Alec Bohm had a hot streak there, and that disappeared during the course of the West Coast road trip. I mean, JT Realmuto, no one was expecting him to be an all-star catcher anymore. But, like, that's – you talk about a position of organizational weakness in the minor leagues. They have nothing coming up at catcher, having traded Eduardo Tait away.
Boy.
Yeah, going to be a fun couple of years. It's such a catch-22 with these big players who aren't performing because they're paying them a lot of money. And they're what the team is built on. And so you need them to do well. But they're not doing well. And you blame them for that. But it's hard because it's not like they're not trying. Like, we know they're trying. They're being paid a lot to try. And I feel as if they weren't trying, we'd know about it. Because it's as embarrassing for them, too. You know, it's you don't know who. You could put part of the blame on everybody, almost. Because it's not like Dave Dombrowski built a $300 million roster thinking, all right, well, these players, you know, these big players are going to suck at some mm-hmm. point. He did think that, but he didn't think it would be now. He didn't think it would be just a few years after they got, you know, Trey Turner in the fold, like just 1 year after signing, you know, Schwarber to a huge contract. You know, they did not think this. So there's blame. No one's blameless, but I don't know if anyone can take a full share of the blame, because Dombrowski built a team full of guys who should be playing well.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm sorry, not to cut you off, John, but like just to go back, I was looking at these numbers, and just to go back to the way that he's tried to fill this extra outfielder. I know we've talked about it to death, and we all know the names, but it really is remarkable how these don't just not work. They're huge disasters.
Huge,
you know, from things like actively things that aren't terrible. Dombrowski's fault, like Hayes having a kidney infection. But Adolis Garcia hasn't had a hit in six games. Like, that's supposed to be a big party, like a chunk of your offense right there. And it's just nothing. And he's the one picking, you know, putting the names down that, like, all right, well, we need a guy and he's the guy. So, like, there is a pattern to his selection process, too, that's not great.
No, and see, here's part of the problem. There's such a shortage of right-handed outfielders in baseball, too. Mm-hmm. So I get that the pool, when you were looking this offseason, was thin. So this is where player development would really come in handy. This is where identifying some players, some young players, and transitioning them to the outfield, or being able to develop and pick the right players to draft, or in the international market, or whatever it happens to be. I don't know where the breakdown is in all of this. Is it who they're selecting? Is it how they're being developed? I just, I don't know where the breakdown is with regards to being able to generate players, but there's just in baseball, there's people are having a hard time finding right-handed hitting outfielders. So they picked Adolis Garcia, you know, as their bargain bin guy, you know, because they wanted a right-hander, and we all knew that that was something that they needed this offseason. He's 3 for his last 57 coming into Tuesday's series against San Diego with 30 strikeouts over that time. He had 11 hits total in the month of May in 100 plate appearances. He's hitting under 200, 191 batting average, only 4 home runs. I mean, you figured he would just accidentally hit some home runs, but he can't hit the fastball right now. He's swinging at everything outside the strike zone. He needs to sit for a few days at least, and we are approaching DFA time, because if this is the production you're going to get from Adolis Garcia at the plate, it doesn't matter how great his defense is in right field. It just truly doesn't. I'm sorry, he's made some great plays out there. I love his arm. The diving catch he had in Los Angeles was absolutely tremendous, but it's not enough production. You can't have that. You can't have a guy who is one of the worst offensive players in right field, and by the numbers right now, one of the worst offensive players in center field playing next to each other, and also be awful at third base, also be awful at shortstop, also be awful at second base, also be awful at catcher offensively in all of these different places and have it succeed. And right field is the one guy that you only are paying like one, you have 1 year left for. I know Bohm's on the last year of his deal. You're not DFAing Alec Bohm. So I just, with Adolis Garcia, I don't know how much more rope he has here, Liz. What kind of length does he have in terms of being able to hold on to this roster spot? And at the very least, should he be in the starting lineup on Tuesday against San Diego? Or is it time for him to get an extended Alec Bohm-like break?
I think he could use a few days of sitting. But the Phillies have a problem, and that's the problem that we've just been talking about. They don't really have anybody to put there, even to sit just a day or two.
Edmundo Sosa plays outfield now. There's an answer.
Does he really play outfield? I'm not sure that's true. The Phillies can say it. That doesn't make it so. He holds on to the job as long as the Phillies don't have a better option, and they don't have a better option right now. Their better option is starting Edmundo Sosa full time in right field, which is the worst idea I've ever heard.
You know, there's some key differences between why they won in San Diego and why they lost in Los Angeles, and one of them was what we were talking about, the pitching. You got a great Nola start in San Diego that you were able to use to hold up to other more predictably great starts, and they leaned on that, they generated enough offense, and they won all three games. In Los Angeles, you had a rough Lizardo outing and a bad Andrew Painter outing, and that kind of like knocked your legs out from under you in some cases. But one of the other main differences was Kyle Schwarber, who crushes in San Diego and hit .417 in that series and hit a big home run and a bunch of hits. In Los Angeles, he struck out in 7 out of 13 at bats. And when he's going cold, which we know that he can go cold, same as Harper can go cold, as hot as they can get, and then you have Adolis Garcia in your lineup, that's like an extra, like that, like that's a hole in your lineup, and then it's their turn to be a hole in their lineup, which we know is cyclically going to happen at times. And when they're all like flipped over the wrong way, it just makes Garcia look like even bigger, because he's an automatic hole in that, automatic out, like in that lineup. And the way this offense works, they can all be automatic outs sometimes, it feels like. And it's like you can't have it. And it's just how this offense has been trying to get away with it for so long. It's like the opposite of that "they can't keep getting away with it" meme. They continue to not get away with it.
It really is amazing. It really is amazing.
It appears a lot. Oh, I'm sorry, John. Go ahead.
What did you say?
So it appears a lot that they're doing fine, but like the numbers underneath are terrible. I looked at, you know, power rankings, MLB, Fangraphs, and CBS, just to see where the Phillies were. Everyone had them up at least 3 spots, if not 4 or 5. Like they went 4-2 on this road trip. They're fabulous. Look at this. They're certainly competing again. And I'm
nobody's watching.
No, I know. Why should they?
Right.
Why should they watch?
Yeah.
We do logically, this because we're paid and we're demented.
Logically, if you moved one of those Padres wins over to the Dodgers pile, and we're talking about 2 series wins instead of a sweep and a loss, That's going to do a lot for people because, again, it's the Dodgers, and it showed that you did enough, whatever you did, to beat the Dodgers. But, again, the way this played out, it was like a deflating balloon from San Diego to L.A. And, yeah, if you were watching the games, you would know, finishing this road trip, losing a series to the Dodgers with a 9-1 catastrophe on Sunday is not going to leave people whistling when they come into work on Monday.
I will say, too, the San Diego series, if you're looking at these two teams, the Phillies and the Phillies have the second worst batting average in Major League Baseball. The team with the worst batting average in Major League Baseball is the San Diego Padres. You're looking at a team that has very similar issues to the Phillies. So if the Phillies lost two out of three to the only other team in baseball. I mean, they swept the team that was the only other team in baseball that has maybe a worse offense than the Phillies right now. But
I want to say that I was out in San Diego for the Padres series, and I accurately predicted that after Trey Turner continued an inning by booting a ground ball, that Nola was going to give up a home run in that spot, because then it technically wasn't going to be his fault that the inning continued and one of the runs wouldn't be his fault, but he still gives up the home run and it makes the game close. It was the perfect Aaron Nola disaster, and Machado hit it right after I said that, and everybody was like, wow, you really know Aaron Nola. And I was like, as much as any person can know a person, I think we know Aaron Nola.
Without and meeting him.
I'm bringing this up. No, including that. And I'm bringing this up because Aaron Nola has to pitch against the Padres again this week. And I was wondering if you guys think that's a better or worse, because I think it's going to be worse. The idea of Aaron Nola, like a lineup that just faced him, facing him again. I don't know. I don't know if he's got the bag of tricks to get
bad.
Him this close proximity to get him again.
Feels real bad.
I don't know. The thing about it is the Phillies have played San Diego really well over these last
few
years. San Diego does not play well in Philadelphia. And, you know, if Nola has his command, I think he can shut him down again. As badly as this.
What did you say there? What was that? If he has his command. Interesting. Interesting. Okay, continue, please.
These are all caveats, of course, that we're talking about with Aaron Nola. No, you're probably right. You're probably right. But
Well, I was talking about what a disaster his start in San Diego is going to be, and look what happened. So I don't really know anything either.
We don't know. It just depends which guy shows up at the park that day. It really is what it is. So the good news is we have no answers for the offense. The Phillies have no answers for the offense. I think at the end
no
of the day,
does.
And we can move on after this, they've just the batting average is what it's going to be. And again, the average is not the most important thing. They're just making it way too easy on opposing pitchers. The pitchers are going through them like a hot knife through butter. There's no resistance in the at-bats. There's so many 1-2-3 innings. There's so many early pitch weak hits. I mean, you could talk about bad luck all you want to, and that's fine, but you just can watch this team and you can see pitchers are navigating these guys really, really easily. Trey Turner's not hitting the ball hard, with the exception of two games in San Diego. That was a really hot two games from Trey Turner. All the articles start coming out. Is he turning it around? Is this the start of something? Trey Turner gets super excited. He's finishing his swing now. Two long home runs at San Diego, and then that all dissipates and disappears.
No.
Same thing with Stott. Same thing with Bohm. Same thing with a lot of these guys. They have a hot week. Instead of, you know, you can tell with the great players and the not great players. Great players like Harper and Schwarber stay hot for longer, and the slumps are shorter for the most part. The exact opposite is true with the other guys in this lineup right now. And there are no grand solutions here. There are no grand solutions. The time to remake a roster was in the offseason. You can't do it at the trade deadline unless you're just giving up on the season. And
as usual, the team would benefit from having more Brandon Marshes. The kind of successes this team needs are, you know, you think about the core of this team and like the guys on more of the perimeter, and that's where you fill in like your Adolis Garcias and stuff. And those guys are more easily removed and replaced and swapped out. But these guys closer to the center, it's harder to like, you know, rip them out for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And that's what kind of sets the tone. Like, you can acquire more players. You can acquire your right-handed outfielder all you want in whatever capacity you're able to do that, because again, you're kind of handcuffed asset wise. But regardless, you can do that. But at the end of of the day, what you're talking about is improving this team in a way that changes it completely from what it's really like centrally built to do. Like, we know what kind of hitters these guys are, and they've always been those kind of hitters. And yes, we've seen some positive adjustments over the years, but ultimately they're kind of like going to be how they're going to be no matter who else you throw in there. You know, maybe there's a culture change or something and that really flips the vibe, and I don't know. But like at the end of the day, that's pretty much who these guys are. And I'm not saying that makes it hopeless. It just makes it difficult. But then when you have Brandon Marsh, who is a player who comes here, was flawed. The Phillies were like, this is what we have for you. And yeah, he goes up and down. But for the most part, this year, he has been their most consistent and successful hitter. And they just needed more success stories like that. They needed to see that arc from Bryson Stott and Alec Bohm. And they just can't stay on that level. So that's why it's like still blowing your mind to see Marsh play as well as he has, but then also be a team player. Yeah. When they swapped him out for Edmundo Sosa, and like that was a decision we could have spent this entire show talking about if it had gone the other way.
So, yeah, let's do it.
All right. Yeah. Well, then I want to bring up Brandon Marsh's quotes afterwards, which were just some of the like all-time teammate quotes. He was talking about how like sometimes you just need the whole team for a win. Like he's very close friends with Edmundo Sosa, and obviously he wants to play, but he understands, you know, what do you say? I'm ride or die with Donnie Baseball, like already throwing stuff like that out there about his new manager. Like it was the perfect response. Ruben Amaro said a couple of times, if we had just gotten recording of that, I would show it to young players as part of media training as how to answer difficult questions. And, you know, a more toxic player might have been like, well, how dare you take me out? My family was here, and then go hit 170 for another team. But Brandon Marsh is a better player than that and a more mature player than that. And having more of him on this team would be fantastic. But, you know, it's just the Phillies just aren't rich in success stories like that.
That's a really great point. And you had, you know, for teams with like the 2008 Phillies with Jason Worth, how they were able to unearth and get him to be the player that he became, and Shane Victorino. I mean, these are guys who kind of remind you a lot of like Brandon Marsh and Bryson Stott and Alec Bohm, like a similar type of feels like ability and pedigree and all that kind of stuff. But those guys were able to figure it out. And it's hard to say that Bohm and Stott and those guys haven't, because they've been a part of a successful team for the last 4 years. They've all had really good moments. Bohm's made an all-star team. Bryson Stott felt like he had a great 23 season. I mean, they've all had their moments, but Brandon Marsh is really the only one of them to kind of establish themselves. And yet Don Mattingly removes him from the game, the one game they win on Saturday against a left-handed reliever in the sixth inning, with the bases loaded and one out, the only guy on your team hitting over 300. He's hitting lefties and righties right now. You've already basically said Brandon Marsh is an everyday player. Don Mattingly has said this. He's been playing him against left-handed starters. So removing him in that spot, like one of the most dependable hitters on your team for the last calendar year. Like this is not something that just popped up. He's been a really good, consistent, productive hitter for the last year. To remove him for Edmundo Sosa, because Sosa hits right-handed and has a history of hitting well against lefties. The histories there, great, but what's happening right now? I've liked what Don Mattingly has done for the most part, but man, did he talk himself into a boneheaded move there with the bases loaded and one out.
So dumb.
It blew up in his face spectacularly, and he lucked out that Edmundo Sosa hits a two-run home run a couple of innings later to give them the winning margin, because they should have been swept in that series.
I saw Francisco Alvarez of the Mets have the least competitive at bat I've ever seen. That made you wonder if he should be in professional baseball last year. That is the only at bat that maybe was less competitive than Sosa's swinging. Yep. His pitch selection in that at bat was comically awful by his own admission later. It is absurd that all went down.
Well, and afterwards, Brandon Marsh, after he came back to the dugout, Brandon Marsh gave him like a clap on the back, like, that's all right. You know, and then after the home run, he was, of course, super excited. But, like, he was on board with the decision immediately. Like, there's no vanity in Brandon Marsh. You can tell he feels really lucky to be where he is. And he understands the type of opportunity he's got. And, you know, the money that he can make if he continues just to play well and be a good person. Just answer questions well and look like you're a human being. That's something that a lot of baseball players struggle with, weirdly. They have a hard time answering questions, and hearing something like that from Brandon Marsh is just refreshing, and it reminds you, oh, baseball players can be like this.
Yeah. No, without, I mean, he is egoless, which is a really cool thing to see. Mm-hmm. And he just generally loves his teammates and wants the team to win. And so he's a great example for young players. I think Ruben Amaro's right. He's a great example for young players to look at.
We all need a Brandon Marsh.
We could all use a Brandon Marsh in our lives, a hype man in our own lives. Nick Castellanos returns to Philadelphia for the first time this week. I don't feel like we've talked about that. Yeah, I know, right? I mean, because he's not playing well in San Diego. He's playing terrible baseball. The Phillies are paying him $19 million this year to play terrible baseball for San Diego.
So fabulous.
In addition to $10 million for Adolis Garcia to play terrible baseball, offensively anyway, for the Phillies. So that's $29 million well spent. But I'm curious what you guys think the fan reaction will be to Nicholas Castellanos, because he had some good moments here in his time in Philadelphia, had some big hits in some big spots. Obviously, it was a very messy divorce here over the course of the last year. And there have been a lot of moments where Castellanos frustrated Phillies fans. It was a real, at times, love-hate relationship with him. When he gets introduced or he comes on to the field, I feel like back, this was like the 90s or the 2000s, and Veterans Stadium was still around. I would feel like the vitriol that would be thrown at him would be fierce. I mean, maybe not at J.D. Drew levels or anything like that, but Scott Rolen level of dislike, you know? I mean, I think that dissipated over time. I feel like the fan base is in a different place now than it used to be. I don't feel like I don't think there'll be quite as much animosity towards Nick Castellanos, but I do think there will be a significant number of boos when he hits the Citizens Bank Park field. Liz, what are you anticipating in terms of fan reaction to Nick Castellanos when he takes the field at some point in this series?
Oh, there will be boos, mostly because Phillies fans are looking for something to boo that is not their own team. Not that they wouldn't do that and have this season recently, but Phillies fans are restless, and I think there'll be a lot of booing. I don't know if there'll be any cheers. I would love to be wrong. Actually, I don't care about being wrong. It's Nick Castellanos, but I think there'll be a fair amount, maybe not vitriol, but some booing, if not good-natured, then just fairly annoyed that the breakup was so bad and he acted like such a baby.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you criticize Nick Castellanos, I will say you'll get a little bit of pushback from people who really dig that misunderstood philosopher thing he likes to push, that he's just, I'm a little different, and maybe that's because I like know something you don't. And you're like, oh, maybe. And then by the time that he was leaving town, I was like, I don't know about that. But that mentality, you know, is great for a team where you're winning and obviously not where you're losing. And part of me thinks there's enough that Phillies fans are frustrated about right now that like their rivalry with Nick Castellanos maybe takes a back burner. I think I'll tell you what the difference is. It's going to be, does the team give him a little highlights package on the big screen? And I'm kind of thinking maybe in some cases they would, but I don't think the team's got a great relationship with him either. So I don't know if that's going to happen. If it did, I think you get more applause than boos, because you're reminding people directly of, hey, remember like a couple of, you know, diving catches, a couple of clutch hits. Like he was there and he helped. You can remind people, and a lot of people do remember, but if there's no package like that, then I think the team's almost kind of leaning into the, yeah, go ahead. But I don't think it's, you're right. I don't think it's going to be like, you know, the worst you've ever seen. I'm not sure how much of the even like taboo or not taboo headlines you're going to see going into this series right. That you always get. Yeah, I think there's other things to worry about right now, but, I mean, who doesn't love giving a guy like that a little extra attention?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a while since Phillies fans have had a villain to root against. I'm trying to remember, really, like, who was the last guy fan base...
Arcia?
Really... Who?
Arcia in the playoffs.
Yeah, okay. Okay, Arcia is probably the last one. Yep, that was a good... But that was another team's player, and I guess that's kind of what... Because J.D. Drew never played for the Phillies. Scott Rolen was a Philly, but then went to the Cardinals. It can be both. It can be a former Philly who has left. I feel like, you know, and I remember Phillies fans really were upset with Jason Wirth when he
I
left.
I just said, yeah, Jason Wirth is definitely the last player I remember there being any significant controversy over, like, to boo or not to boo. Because he was, you know... kind of sore leaving as well, because I don't think he felt the, if I remember, I don't think he felt the offer the Phillies gave him was enough. And so he took an enormous deal with the Nationals.
Yeah.
And said some nasty things, and then Phillies fans were nasty to him, and then that relationship was broken until a couple of years ago. But I don't, this doesn't rise to the level of that. Like, they didn't win in 22, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, if he had, if there had been a World Series championship, of course he'd be cheered. He'd have, everyone would be like, remember well, that.
Worth won a championship. Worth won the World Series with the Phillies and then got booed. So I don't know. It's just anytime you're jilted, it really doesn't matter. You know, I mean,
yep.
It's just.
I remember when Cesar Hernandez came back and was like, oh, I thought I was going to get a standing O, and they didn't give him one, which I do feel kind of bad about.
I feel bad for
I'm
him.
Pretty he sure he's...
I thought about that recently, too.
Oh. He was one of their franchise hits leaders in the 2010s, yeah. I'm pretty sure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. All that guy did was his best. You know what I mean? Like, so it's that was unfair. That was totally unfair. All right. Well, the Padres come in for a three-game series at Citizens Bank Park. The Phillies really need to get some, start banking some home victories against some good teams here to get a little bit of a good feeling going. And maybe this is the month. June is usually a better month for the Phillies bats, I think, historically, as the weather warms up. So hopefully that will be the case, especially for somebody like Schwarber, who's always done well in the month of June. Let's wrap up with some final thoughts as we enter our Tuesday. Justin, any final thoughts?
First of all, yeah, Liz and I talked about the Padres as an opponent for the Phillies. And John, you kind of made reference to this. And the truth is that even a good Padres team just doesn't scare me. And part of that is just because of the Phillies' success against them. Or they like what we calculate, they were like 9-3, before that, or maybe after that series in the last like couple games. Like they also have statistically played the Dodgers well in the regular season. Not as much of a factor here, but yeah, playing the Padres again is somewhat of a welcome development, even with any flaws the Padres may be able to exploit, having just gotten a good look at the Phillies. Another thing is there'll be a new Dirty Inning this week over at the Hit and Season Patreon, a whole fresh junk drawer of statistics about the Phillies, unearthed some great stories, and we zeroed in on the losing streak from 1961. The 1961 Phillies, another team that compared with their overall offensive output with the 2026 Phillies. So we'll talk about a horrific rough streak for Gene Mock's 1961 Phillies, who also lost a ton of games. And finally, Bryce Harper was talked to by, I believe, ESPN about the forthcoming labor disputes in baseball. He's talked about how they're coming from two different areas, the players and owners. But we both have to understand our game is in a great position right now to succeed, and we can't lose that momentum. We can't lose that momentum as players. We can't lose that momentum as owners. So wherever we're at, whatever they're coming with, whatever we're coming with, you have to come to an agreement before any of that happens, because there's other things to do. It's not like 94 where there was just nothing else to do. It's not just, oh, baseball's here. Now there's a lot of other things to do than just watch baseball. First of all, I love this quote because I, too, in 1994 was like, yeah, I mean, there's baseball. What else are we going to do? Yeah. Totally registers. Completely relatable mindset. No questions asked about what was going on with Bryce Harper in 94. Secondly, do you feel, and this was something I saw brought up, not by anyone real, just like some guy, but is Bryce Harper a sympathetic enough figure to be at the forefront of the players like fight here? Because he's obviously a very rich Major League Baseball player. He's a superstar. And among other fans, they still kind of see him as the guy he was earlier in his career, kind of like argumentative, cantankerous, has this attitude. Like some people don't like Bryce Harper. And I saw someone putting that out there as like, it's not going to get people on the player's side. And there's, word is that all the little whispers the owners have put out there to try and get fans on their side in this have been more effective this time around than in the past. So do you feel like Bryce Harper is a sympathetic enough figure to be any kind of leader on the player's side of this debate?
Well, it's not like the leader last time, Max Scherzer, was universally beloved. So I think it just matters a lot what he's saying and how he's saying it. Now, I'll be honest, that last statement was kind of awkward and weird. It would be great if he could get a... I mean, how is he not trained for media? Bruce Meyer, the head of the Players Association, has to sit down with some of these guys and be like, hey, this is union language. This is the language of organizing. This is the language you need to be using. You need to be talking about player solidarity, not about coming to an agreement with the guys who are trying to, you know, take your future earnings away, which is what they're trying to do. Take future earnings away and put them in the pocket of whoever buys their team in, you know, however many years until John Middleton dies. So, yeah, he's maybe not the best, but he's the one who's willing to speak up. And on these issues, that's like the only qualification. If you're willing to speak up about this, they want you to, because a lot of people are not comfortable with talking about this. I think the vast majority of players aren't comfortable with talking about the union.
And I thought the quotes were very interesting, because this is the same guy who almost got into a fist fight with the commissioner of baseball last summer.
This
and
is
now
intentional.
It sounded like, are we ringing a bell of compromise here? Like, is that what he's trying to say? So
He's just trying to look better.
That's definitely part of it. And, you know, maybe he is, you know, talking with union folks. Maybe this is part of, you know, posturing in the media. I mean, both sides are posturing right now, but maybe it was just Bryce in an honest moment saying he doesn't want there to be a strike. He doesn't want there to be a lockout, whatever it might be. But we're at the beginning stages of this. I know you guys discussed it on the previous issue, previous episode of Hit and Season, broke it down really well. So both sides continue to put out statements and respond to each other, and that's going to be the tone of the summer.
Also, Bryce, they did have Sega in 1994. Just saying.
That's true. That's true. Sonic the Hedgehog was...
something to note. Put it in your notes.
That's right. Liz, final thoughts?
I gave my final thought already talking about the union, so we could just skip me.
All right. All right, but well, that'll do it then for this edition of Hit and Season. I want to remind everybody that if you're listening to this podcast and you'd like to start watching the roundtables, they can be found over at the WHYY YouTube channel. And if you subscribe to the WHYY YouTube channel, you'll get every episode of the roundtable right there. And we also have clips and highlights of the show there as well. So if you're watching us on YouTube and you have friends who just want to listen to podcasts, and we are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, anywhere you get your podcasts, that's where we are. If you listen to us on Apple and could leave a 5-star rating or a review, that definitely would help the show in a very big way. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time right here on Hit and Season.